We want to alert you that some of the content you're about to hear in these podcasts could be upsetting and distressing. So please be aware, this may not be the right moment to listen. Given recent news, it was most appropriate that we dedicated one edition of Child Protection Committee Scotland's series of themed podcasts to grooming. And that's because grooming, particularly the variety which is perpetrated by gangs of men on young victims, has been back in the news recently. The flurry of renewed attention came about because of some provocative and deeply accusatory comments posted on X by tech billionaire Elon Musk about how the UK handled, or didn't handle, grooming gang cases. But in case you didn't know, grooming is a crime which is not only committed by gangs. Many children are groomed by individuals operating online and in person. In fact, according to research released by the NSPCC in November last year, online grooming crimes against children in the UK have increased by a staggering 89% in just 6 years. To help us understand what we can do better to protect our children from this form of sophisticated child abuse, we were joined by two special guests. I began by asking them to introduce themselves.
Thanks very much, Claire. My name's Daljeet Dagan and I spent many years working with Barnardo's, the children's charity, in relation to child sexual abuse, but I am currently an independent trainer and consultant with the Centre of Expertise for Child Sexual Abuse, which is based down south.
Brilliant. Thank you, Daljeet. And you are, sir?
Lovely to be with you today. My name is Stuart Allardyce. I'm a social worker by training. I have worked in the child sexual abuse field for about the last 25 years. I'm the director of the child protection charity Lucy Faithful Foundation Scotland. And I'm also chair of NOTA, which is the membership association for those who work with sex offenders.
Thank you for explaining all that to us. Now, I guess we start at the very beginning here because we're talking about grooming. Right, I'm going to get you both to give me your definition of grooming. Daljeet.
So just to keep it very simple, grooming for me is when someone, because it doesn't have to be an adult, it can also be another child or young person. So when someone builds an emotional connection with a child to gain their trust for the purposes of abuse and exploitation.
And for you, Stuart?
It's a really good question because I think there's lots of confusion about what grooming is. And I think sometimes people kind of mix up grooming and abuse. You see that particularly in the media at the moment.
Give me an explanation of that just so that we're very, very clear what we're talking about.
So
here.
The definition I would work with, and there is no statutory definition, let's be very clear about this. And there's even a lack of consensus amongst kind of research. But I think generally what we're talking about is potential perpetrators getting the trust of a child or the people around a child to be able to facilitate abuse and then to prevent disclosure from the child.
So basically do something and then they're not going to say anything about it. They're never going to report it. That's the way it is.
As Daljeet says, it's the stuff about the relationship building that happens before abuse takes place.
Which can be pretty sophisticated, and we'll maybe get into that and how widespread it is. But that brings me on to my second question.
Sorry, Claire. See, just on that though, I suppose what I would want to also add to what Stuart said is that it's a premeditated act.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
So this is not something that happens ad hoc.
So in terms of the actual perpetrator, they've got an end in sight, and that end is usually, but not always, but usually to abuse and exploit a child or an adult. But it's a premeditated act. It's not something that just happens.
Right. I want to ask you, maybe we'll go into the gender thing as well a bit later on, but how big a problem is grooming in the larger term in Scotland at the moment?
I mean, again, I think just as Stuart said, there's no definition of grooming.
Do you think, and I'll come to you in a minute, Stuart, do you think we are now more aware of it as a problem and we will be likely to notice it more? Or is that an area that we're going to have to explore how we...
I think we've always been aware. I think we've always been able to notice. I think the bit that we need to shift is people understanding that it's their role to then tell somebody. So it's not just about noticing, but it's also passing those concerns on to the relevant people. so that children can get the best support and protection at the time that they need it.
Stuart, I think you said you've been in the biz for about 25 years. That's a long time to look back. Do you think the scale of the problem has always been big, or do you think we are now facing something that is quite potentially gigantic for society to grapple with?
I think it's always been big. I think the data probably suggests that it's growing as an issue. We know that recorded sexual crime has been increasing over the last kind of 30 years, including sexual crimes against children in Scotland. That might be better identification, of course, but I think things around online harm would suggest that actually we have a growing problem. The question of the scale of the problem, it's difficult to estimate that, but here's a couple of different ways of looking at it. Daljeet mentioned the Centre for Expertise for Child Sexual Abuse, which produced a really helpful summary a few years ago, looking at what all the data tells us about the prevalence of child sexual abuse and exploitation in the UK across different kinds of studies. And what they concluded was probably around 1 in 10 children have experienced sexual abuse or exploitation by the age of 16. So the children who are known within the child protection system are just the tip of the iceberg. Now, not all of those children will have experienced grooming, and we can maybe kind of unpack that a little bit more later on. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is bearing in mind that grooming can take place offline and it can take place online. Childlight, which is the data lab for child sexual abuse at Edinburgh University, they produced some data last year where they estimated in Scotland alone there were 150,000 children who were groomed online last year.
But then we get 150,000 in 1 year.
But then we get into definitional issues, because every time a child, for instance, has somebody who has started a sexual conversation with them, even though no abuse then happens because the child rebuffs that or does protective things, would come under that definition.
So that's recorded as an initiation of a process that generally leads to, or more often than not leads to, some sort of connection.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And I was just going to say, and that process is important, right? Because actually, in Scotland, we've got very good legislation around grooming.
And tell us what we've got and then tell us about the process being important.
So it's the 2006 legislation. But what I was going to say to you was that one of the things that I've always said to people during training is that we don't have to wait until a child has been raped before we enact that legislation, because that legislation very clearly understands that process, which involves the targeting of a child. Do you know what I mean? So it doesn't have to result with somebody being harmed.
Why are people not then intervening earlier? What's stopping them from doing that?
Because we're not trusting our gut instincts, which tell us that this could be the sign, that this could be a sign or an indicator. I think people really struggle with the possibility of getting it wrong. And the thing I've always said is, never think about what if I'm wrong, think if what if I'm right. It's better to make a mistake and hold your hands up than to actually notice something and think, I wonder if this could be, and choose not to do something about it.
But this is something that's come up in the other podcasts as well. But there's that phrase again, gut feeling. That's not scientific. That's a visceral thing. And that does require, I won't go too far into this, but it does, Stuart, require you to have some sense of confidence that you're going to put your neck out and say something might be happening here. And... will it be reported? Don't know.
The complexities are that certainly contact sexual abuse will typically take place in a relational way. Let me give you an example, because I think one of the challenges here is that we have a kind of set of kind of myths and assumptions about what child sexual abuse is and isn't, and who causes harm to children, which actually get in the way of this. I have a colleague who attended some of the hearings of the Royal Commission in Australia, and there was some abuse being talked about that had been perpetrated in a Jesuit community. Much of that abuse took place, perpetrated by one individual, in plain sight, often by people around them. Other Jesuits within the community were asked, you've told us that you walked into a room and you saw this priest with a 9-year-old child on his knee, and there was no explanation about why a 9-year-old child should have been in the room with him. Why didn't you do anything about that? And the response they gave was, well, we didn't do anything because we didn't think he was a paedophile. And we didn't think he was a paedophile because he was quite young, he was quite good looking, he was quite charismatic, and we liked him. That's the important thing. We liked him, and we don't like paedophiles. So I think that thing about people have gut feelings, but they often...
The person
that they would then need to out is somebody that they know.
Yes.
And that's the painful disconnect.
That's the whole other dimension. And actually what Stuart said there is really, really important, because the people that harm are known to children. They're not strangers. I grew up in the city, and I grew up with messages that were about stranger danger when I was growing up, and we still give those messages to children, and that's the messages and the guidance that parents also have. Do you know what I mean? And particularly about online abuse, you know, so if children think that they're talking to somebody either in the physical world or in the digital world that they know, then of course this person's not going to harm them because they have built up this relationship and it's built on trust.
It feels safe.
It feels safe, absolutely. But however, the media also, I think, sometimes reinforces particular messages of what offenders look like.
Right, let's go into that, because I was just about to ask you that, and that was brilliant that you said that the term perpetrator, you've got an idea in your head of what a perpetrator looks like, what they could be. It will surprise us, won't it, Daljeet? I think you're about to. So come on, disabuse us of that notion.
So there is no typical perpetrator.
It's anyone.
Offender.
It can be anyone.
Anybody, you know.
Of any rank, of any standing.
Male, female, somebody in a position of trust, somebody who's your neighbour, somebody who's in your family, somebody who's a friend, somebody who's a peer. Do you know what I mean? But I think atypically it's not a white man in a long mac, for instance, you know, and that was the imagery that I was kind of given as a child, you know, but it can be somebody, just as Stuart has said earlier on, somebody that you like and somebody that you trust.
And someone that's hiding in plain sight.
Absolutely.
And unless you know what you should be looking out for, then you would never guess. So I'm wondering, in terms of gender and targeting, is it the same for boys and girls? If somebody's, is it the same risk? Because it's young people? Or are girls more susceptible to a particular sort of targeting by perpetrators?
When individuals are grooming girls, they will often put a lot of energy and effort into building a relationship with the girl.
How much effort? How much time? Just give us an idea.
These things can still happen quickly, but generally what will happen, the most common trajectory is, first of all, we're talking more about teenagers than younger children. That's important for people to know about. Because sometimes when we talk about child sexual abuse, we kind of think, oh, it's really young children. Young children are abused. But actually, teenage girls are probably the group that are kind of highest risk. And what generally, in terms of modus operandi, offenders will do is that they will look to social media and they will look to things like Instagram and Snapchat and look for teenagers that they're interested in and then start having conversations and then ask for those conversations to move to private, more encrypted spaces, which could even just be WhatsApp. But it could be Telegram or these kind of apps as well.
Is that always going to be a red flag, or is it quite legit to say to somebody, I'd like a chat, you know, on another platform? You think that's a pretty big red flag?
I would certainly suggest that's... You know,
she's not so sure.
Let me just finish my point and then you can come back in on that. That's an interesting one. I think, you know, what we know about boys, and there is some interesting stuff going on about boys and exploitation at the moment, some of which is about sexploitation, where we're seeing a real significant shift where quite large numbers of boys in Scotland and beyond are being encouraged by individuals who often set themselves up as girls to share images of themselves and then actually being financially exploited on the back of that. That's a significant issue. But also, it looks like from the data we have, gay and bisexual boys and young men are as likely to be sexually abused online as cisgender heterosexual girls. But what's interesting, and this is the key bit, is that often those who are exploiting young men are grooming in quite a different way without the same stuff about relationship building, but often just going straight to sexual stuff. Have you looked at porn?
Wow, it's just that black and white.
Yeah, yeah. Straight to it. So we do see gender differences, but there should be some kind of caution in overgeneralizing. But
and you're dying to jump in, so come on, Dalgy.
I suppose there's a couple of things from what Stuart said. I think for me, it's interesting when we talk about grooming, because often we think about sexual abuse and exploitation when we talk about grooming. So I think Stuart's made a really good point in terms of financial exploitation, because we know when it comes to online, boys are much more likely to be financially exploited online as a result of being coerced into sharing images, for instance. That's a fact. However, all the imagery around sexual abuse and exploitation that we all experience is about girls and how vulnerable girls are, right? So if that's the imagery that we are portraying, then of course boys are going to think, this doesn't happen to me. This isn't going to happen to me. I'm not vulnerable. Therefore, they're not attuned to some of those tactics that perpetrators may use. So my starting point is about how do we ensure children and young people are more resilient? How we ensure that is by making sure that we're having these kinds of conversations in the same way that we would have a conversation about, so what were you doing last night? Or what are you eating tonight? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And the problem is, I don't think adults, whether they're parents and carers or whether they are professionals, are very good at having those types of conversations. Even something as basic as, are you into porn? What porn have you watched? See, do you know what I mean?
I mean, some parents would be like, can you imagine putting that to my teenage son or daughter? The idea that you would even broach that.
The kids are talking about it all the time.
They are.
Kids are having these conversations, and the people that have problems with having these conversations are people like us, actually. Do you know what I mean? And we need to get better at having those types of conversations, so that if there's a red flag for a child or a young person and they're not sure, they should have the confidence to be able to speak to somebody that they trust.
That they're not judging them and are opening the conversation to that possibility that something might be going awry.
But just now, we've all grown up and our children are growing up not being able to have those conversations in a comfortable setting. When I was growing up, most of my conversations, most of my exploration was done with my peers, right? And they knew less than what I knew. Right. Now children are grown up and they're Googling everything. That's how they get their information. So if someone's opening up a conversation with them online, then of course they're going to then, it's going to become a two-way dialogue. So if someone's saying, why don't we have this conversation in a private space on a different platform, it's not going to be a red flag.
I see
necessarily.
Well, I mean, we're getting into that really important kind of conversation about what parents need to know.
Yes.
And also what, you know, child protection professionals need to be able to tell parents and cascade to parents.
And I'm hearing two different things from two experts here, so I'm already thinking, gosh, which way do we go? So what do we do? How do we proceed with this then?
Children in Scotland did some research a few years ago where they asked quite a big cohort of young people, where do they get sexual information and knowledge about, and where do they want to get sexual information or knowledge from? Right at the bottom of the list about where they wanted to get information from was their mum. And then right at the bottom of the pile, their dad.
Mm-hmm. Right at the bottom.
Right at the bottom. So your reaction about actually how the hell do parents kind of start these conversations, I think is really difficult. But I think there are some things that parents can think about. One of which is that, you know, opening up the conversation without a context is probably not going to be that helpful.
And quite weird, probably.
But yes, exactly. And it just feels clunky and unhelpful. And we'll just put children on guard. But, you know, when things come up on TV, with things that are in the news, things that people are talking about, those are the hooks, the handles that people can hang those conversations on. And there are some websites that can kind of give you some stuff, some ideas around conversational gambits. But I think, you know, thinking about not directing the conversation being about what the child does themselves, but about their peers, that thing saying to your 14-year-old child, you know, I hear the stuff in the news that kids are sharing these sexual images of themselves all the time in schools. Have you got pals who have done that? Is that something that happens in your school? Not asking them directly about it. And then thinking about the kind of key messaging that children need to hear, which is, at the end of the day, if there is anything that concerns them, making sure that they know that they can go and speak to a safe adult. Maybe not their parents, but it could be their parents, but it could be other people in all of that. And one last message, I think. So some of the work that we've done in Lucy Faithfull Foundation Scotland, working with young people themselves and looking at what the barriers are for young people reaching out for help. Young people with respect to online behaviour will often say, I won't go and speak to an adult because I'm really worried the adults will take away my electronic devices.
That's a huge risk, isn't it? They don't want that to happen.
Yeah. So and then they're isolated. So being able to say to a child, look, you know, our priority as adults is your safety. And if you come to us with a problem, you can have our guarantee that we'll do everything we can to keep you online. It might not be possible, but actually that's what we want
it's
to do.
It's not punitive to you. Yes. It's absolutely fascinating. I do want to talk about next how people, perpetrators, go about identifying and grooming their victims. But I was also thinking about the gender thing there. Societally, I think we're generally assuming it's a guy that's doing a lot of this. That's not right, is it, Daljeet?
No, I think it's always been a particular bugbearer of mine that we have a stereotypical view of who the perpetrators are and who the victims are. And actually, in reality, the perpetrator can be anybody, and similarly in terms of a victim. However, I think we feel more comfortable accepting that it's a man because I think we often have very different views of how women should behave in terms of being nurturing. Do you know what I mean? So how could a woman harm? And also, if a woman's harming, surely she must be being coerced herself. Now, in some cases, that will be the case. In other cases, that won't be the case. And again, talking about, you know, what we were earlier on about boys in particular, I mean, like, certainly a number of the boys that I've worked with over the years who were actually groomed online by women, where they were talking about the things that the boy was interested in, whether it was football or whether it was online gaming.
Seemingly innocuous
so
stuff.
So having a shared interest and tapping into that shared interest and using that as the hook to actually, you know, coerce and manipulate that child. So in terms of, you know, vulnerability, you know, at the end of the day, children are vulnerable by dint of being a child. But it's also about there are some particular vulnerabilities. You know, so research does tell us that there's actually three groups of children who are more vulnerable than anybody else. And those three groups are children with a disability, whether it's children with a physical or learning disability. It's children who've already been sexually abused as children, whether they've shared that information or whether anyone's bothered to ask is another matter. And the third group of children are children who have become disconnected from family and have had to be looked after by the state. So those three groups, in terms of research, are definitely the most vulnerable. However, from practice wisdom, what I would also tell you that is that children who are also vulnerable are those children who go missing. So either running to or running away from. And that behaviour in itself should tell us something in terms of this child doesn't feel safe, in terms of where they are. So, and also children who've suffered some kind of bereavement or significant loss in their life are also vulnerable. And that last piece of information came specifically from research down south in relation to gangs and gang exploitation. So that's where some of that information's coming from.
You want to add something to that, Stuart?
Everything Daljeet has said is correct. The data would also say more girls than boys are abused, although there may be issues around underreporting and all of that. I mentioned the stuff around, you know, LGBT plus who are more at risk. Mental health issues is often kind of featured as a risk factor, both offline and online. But also, you know, there's some key stuff that Daljeet is saying, that particularly those children and young people who are estranged from protective adults in their life. I mean, that's really what those who are grooming online and offline are looking for.
Yep, definitely. And that estrangement doesn't have to be a physical estrangement as well, because actually, if you think about supervision, the kind of supervision of children, now, when we think about online, that seems dead easy because often children are interacting, using a device that's held in their hand most often than not. But actually, you know, if you think about a child who maybe is spending time out with the family home, or you've got a parent that's spending time out with the family home, that lack of supervision is always an alert to somebody who wants to harm a child that actually this is a child that I can access without too much difficulty, because there isn't somebody who hasn't got that child in mind all the time.
They're under radar.
And of course, the act of grooming, going back to, you know, the subject we're talking about, is often the explicit thing that is done by the perpetrator or potential perpetrator to isolate the child even more.
Yep.
So, you know, that conversation that the abusive adult will have, say, yeah, well, of course your mum doesn't listen to you.
So it's pretty manipulative.
Yes,
they
absolutely
know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They know what the form of words is and the right things to hit.
And we also need to understand that people who groom don't just groom children. They also groom the people around the child.
Right. This is really important, because that you can sucker a lot of people and people don't have any idea they're being had. We've heard this from other podcasts. You can have people around them that have no clue as to what that person is actually like. How on earth, again, are there any red flags for that? If we're talking about just generally in society thinking, you know, we should be looking out beyond what radiates out from where that child is at the core.
See, I think the most important thing for me is that actually people who groom, and we've mentioned this before, use very sophisticated methods and techniques. They've honed their skills in relation to this. They've got quite a lot to gain, but they've also got quite a lot to lose. Do you know what I mean? So you can understand how people get sucked in, right? Whether that's a child, whether that's a parent who's just overwhelmed, for instance, whether that's a professional who's overwhelmed, or wanting to see the best in people, or looking for the wrong things because they've got a stereotypical view of what a perpetrator looks like. Right? But what we need to focus our attention on is who grooms and why they groom and what their motivations are. Because actually, if we're going to make a difference, we also need to think about who is grooming, and also how we can disrupt that behaviour, as well as how we can prevent it from happening in the first place.
So where's the starting point for all that? Because that all makes absolute sense, but you might just be thinking, you'd be so suspicious of everyone that comes into contact with a child.
Yes, and I think there is a danger that we begin to kind of shift into, you know, like a high level of surveillance society and all of this. But I think there is a kind of reasonable middle ground here. I think one of the issues here is that, quite understandably, you know, a lot of what we know about child sexual abuse comes from the media, mainstream media, social media, which often report the most abject and terrible cases you can imagine.
And we've had quite a few of those recently.
And of course, the media should be covering those cases. But it means that we end up having this kind of mental template of what a sex offender is, that it's somebody who's a serial, paedophilically orientated offender. And, you know, we always have these pictures in our head of these ghastly individuals. What that does is it others the idea of who people are who commit sexual offences, where actually sexual offending against children, although sometimes it can be paedophilically orientated, tends to be more opportunistic in nature and tends to be about incremental boundary violation over a period of time. That's the key bit. If it's about incremental boundary violation, then actually there are behaviours we can see. So you can't identify somebody as an offender by what they look like. But if you've got somebody who is repeatedly seeming to lack respect for the privacy of a child or children, somebody who is overly physically affectionate with a child, somebody who has a disproportionate interest in the sexual development of a child, is telling sexual jokes with the child, is spending lots of time with the child on their own without any reasonable explanation, is giving gifts to the child without a reasonable explanation. Now, all of those things individually can have completely, perfectly sensible contexts. But the more of those things that you see, the more you should begin to think, actually, is this reasonable?
Do people do that, though? Do they accumulate a list or do they just keep it in isolation? They think, well, that's a bit odd. And maybe if something really shocking happened, they would notice. But they're not, you know, sitting with an invoice of things that that person's done usually, unless they are suspicious in the first place. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And actually, you know, from a child protection point of view, and it might be something worthwhile people kind of Googling and looking at this, there is quite a lot of interest in the idea of low-level concerns policies within organisations at the moment. You know, how do kind of organisations kind of pick up on those little things that in themselves maybe have a particular kind of context which explains them, but actually how do we allow organisations to begin to build patterns about workers' behaviour? You know, the situation like the residential worker who has a conversation with a 13-year-old girl and another worker thinks, that was a bit sexualised. Where do you go with that? It's not a child protection matter. It maybe sits below your whistleblowing policy, but where does it go?
And where does it go at the moment? That's the thing. Do people tend not to make it go any further because there's not enough evidence and the gut feeling's there, but they're just not going to take that final
step? It's really interesting what Stuart's saying, because actually there was a piece of work that was actually done in Glasgow, and it just happened to be in relation to children who were looked after away from home. And when there was a couple of researchers who went back and looked into case logs, and what they saw and what they read was lots of information that would suggest signs and indicators of sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. Right, they were all there. Mm-hmm. Everything that Stuart has noted and more, including children trying to tell, but no one took responsibility for joining the dots.
There you go. And that is the problem, isn't it? Who's going to join the dots? Who's got the time? Who's got the knowledge? Who's got the empathy or the observational skills to do that? And who should it be? Yeah. All of us?
It is. It's everyone's responsibility to make sure I'm all right. I mean, that's what was a mantra in Scotland for years and years, right? And if you ask children about what makes a difference, what they will tell you is someone noticed and asked me.
Because there's an opportunity then to open up about mm-hmm. other things. But if you're not asked, and again, this is something that's come up in the other podcasts.
And that's why it's really important for us to know what the signs and indicators are. And those signs and indicators are all the things and more that Stuart's just listed there. So essentially, if there's anything that makes you think, I'm not sure about that, I'm not sure how that person looked at her or looked at him or the way they spoke or the fact that they're taking them out in their own time or whatever it is, there needs to be an opportunity for that person to be able to share with somebody else and for something else to happen with that information.
Are we being naive or are we being willfully in denial about what we think might be happening and neglectful? Is that what's happening? That it's too painful for us to go there?
If you look at it very simply, right, child sexual abuse is a child protection issue. And we need to ask ourselves, how many of these issues are being raised in a child protection arena in Scotland today?
Well, what's the answer to that?
I think our child protection statistics will tell you that.
Which means?
Very few children are registered under the category of child sexual abuse.
Something's going wrong then. Mm-hmm.
And that's because we're looking for evidence all the time, rather than thinking that actually on the balance of probabilities, in terms of based on the information that I know or that I've observed or witnessed, I wonder if something else could be happening for this child. And to be able to have that conversation with another professional, whether it's in your own arena, as in your workplace, or whether it's another professional who knows that child.
But you've got to be so careful as a professional and as a civilian that you're not just bandying about, I think that person's a bit dodgy. So again, it's that thing of crossing the boundary to say, no, I'd rather get it wrong, but do something than sit quietly thinking, don't think we've got enough evidence for that. What's your take on it?
I think where I've got to in my career is I don't think the solution is going to be the child protection system. I think it's part of the solution. But we need to get better at talking about prevention of child sexual abuse. Going back to that figure of, you know, if we think kind of 1 in 10 children are affected by sexual abuse by the time they turn 16, as Dalji has said, you know, only a tiny minority of children are known to statutory services because of concerns around sexual abuse. And actually, in most of those situations, there isn't a perpetrator who is convicted with respect to all of this. And in fact, our systems are generally based around waiting for children to tell us that they've been abused.
So that clearly isn't working.
Yep. Yeah. But there are things that we can do. And, you know, the kind of things that we can do, you know, just to kind of talk about our work at Lucy Faithful Foundation for a moment, but we run the Stop It Now helpline. Stop It Now helpline last year, funded by the Home Office, covers the whole of the UK. We had 18,000 calls last year from around 8,000 individuals. And around a third of those calls are from people who want to be protective in a particular situation and want to use a confidential and anonymous space. So those kind of situations where a mum phones us up and says, look, my uncle is playing with my three-year-old daughter in a way that makes me feel really uncomfortable. But I've got nothing to go to police or social work about, and I don't think anything's happened yet. But what can I do in that situation? And in that situation, our helpline staff would talk about, okay, is there a conversation that could be possible with the uncle about parameters here? Is there something around a family safety plan that the mum could implement in some way? Things that actually might make a tangible kind of difference in some way. So we need to get much better at thinking about this as a public health issue and thinking about how we empower parents, children, bystanders in the community to actually do something about this, not just waiting for statutory services to sort out.
I'm immediately thinking, you know, of course this is of great interest to your sector, but what about the civilians, the public, the mums, the dads, the carers? They should hear these conversations. Where do they get the opportunity to hear this stuff? Apart from this podcast, I'm just thinking, you know, where is this conversation taking place that we need to change the way we're looking at protecting children? Mm-hmm. And what public forum is this happening?
It's interesting because, I mean, Stuart and I have had many conversations about how we should see child sexual abuse as a public health issue and therefore our response should be such. And obviously child protection is at the extreme end of that spectrum. But I think it's also about us having a clear understanding of the conversations that we have with members of the public, but also children, in terms of what they can expect, you know, in terms of what is safe touch, what is a healthy relationship and a consensual and respectful relationship. When we were talking earlier on about vulnerabilities, we often find that children who've grown up in an environment where domestic abuse, you know, has been a kind of factor, children can have quite a skewed understanding of what is a respectful relationship. So I do think it's about having those conversations about, you know, what I feel comfortable with. And what I feel comfortable with isn't necessarily what Stuart might feel comfortable with. So it's about being able to open up those conversations about what people can expect from one another, but also what's okay and what's not okay. If we're better versed about having those conversations,
maybe having an idea of what the bottom line is that you can expect for any decent relationship with somebody to be, and spelling that out. And I don't know how you do that apart from just educate and talk about it more.
Well, exactly. Educate and talk about it more. I mean, just to kind of build on what Daljeet's saying. So we've got some research, a few different research studies now that have interviewed adult sex offenders. Can I just kind of throw in something here that we've not talked about young people yet as people cause harm, but we'll maybe come back to that. Yeah. But interviewing adult sex offenders who have abused children and asking them about the situations and contexts where they abused a child and situations and contexts where they wanted to abuse a child, but they didn't do that for whatever reason. And there are two factors that seem to come from that research. One is offenders say, the reason I didn't actually fulfill what I wanted to do was the child said no, victim resistance, which is back to Daljeet's point about we need to get the building blocks in there at an early age about children knowing what is okay.
The parameters.
Yeah. And things like, you know, the NSPCC Pantasaurus and things like that can be brilliant with that, these kind of things. And the other factor was those adult offenders saying, actually, the reason I didn't do anything was there was a risk of adults seeing what I was doing or knowing what I was doing. So it's back to that thing about actually building a relationship with the child, but actually realizing that adults are onto that in some way and are starting to ask some questions about the appropriateness of that.
Yeah.
So it's not rocket science.
You were talking about young people. You wanted to make the point about that then.
It's a complex area, but we do need to recognise that probably around a third of sexual abuse, maybe more, is perpetrated by children and young people under the age of 18 themselves. And indeed, the last data that we have from England and Wales about recorded sexual crime would suggest that actually half of sexual offences against children...
Taking what form? Various forms?
Online and offline abuse, abuse within families, particularly things like sibling abuse, but also abuse within schools, peer and peer, abuse within kind of gangs and communities, a whole range of different kinds of things. Now, grooming does happen in that space. And indeed, the mental picture that we have of online offenders, we often think of, you know, the older middle-aged man in a room. Actually, the data would suggest the age profile of those involved with online solicitation is much younger than that. Mm-hmm. It's also worthwhile kind of bearing in mind that sometimes young people's harmful sexual behaviour and abusive behaviour doesn't involve grooming in the same way or contact, and can be much, much more direct and probably just complicate it a little bit more. I think there's an overlap with complicated stuff around adolescent dating behaviour.
What sort of things, in what way?
And things like, you know, things like online dating violence is a really, really big issue for young
people
nowadays.
Explain what that even is. I mean, what is that?
Young people who are building relationships with young people who are broadly the same age, maybe a little bit older, but broadly the same age, and then finding that they're being coerced, pushed to do sexual things that they don't feel that they're ready for, but also they don't want to disappoint the person that they want to build a relationship with, and indeed want to build a trusting relationship.
It's so conflicted, isn't it?
So I think the stuff that gets swept into that space as well, that is quite complicated, and we don't normally think about that as child sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. But
do you think that is?
Well,
Tell you, have you got a theory?
I was going to go back to when you asked the question, what is that? So when you think about dating apps and websites, you think of Tinder, you think of Grindr, right? We have those equivalents for children and young people, right? So how children and young people meet and interact with, I don't often like using the word peer because they're not always peers, they're not always the same age, but how they meet
other
children
people.
And young people is by mimicking the behaviours of the adults around them. Because if you think about how adults now meet other adults to either have a friendship with or a sexual relationship with, it's through a dating website.
So hold on, there are dating websites for
children,
young
people? Yes.
This is news to me.
They've been around for years and years. We actually got one shut down by Police Scotland about, must be about 5-6 years ago, and it was a dating website that was actually set up in Glasgow, and it was specifically for children aged 13 to 25. Now, if you look at that
that's a huge age range,
right? So that goes back to, you know, Stuart's earlier point about, you know, the spaces that are being created, you know, and some of that, and I suppose what I don't want to do is be all doom and gloom and make people think that there's terrible things that are happening out there, because actually for a lot of young people, a lot of these places and spaces are actually quite healthy,
mm-hmm.
and
fun.
And actually providing opportunities that they wouldn't ordinarily have.
So it's not black and white, this stuff, is it?
It's not easy, you know. So some of that stuff we do want to promote, but it's about how you support that so that, you know, it's something that those that are around children or who have responsibility for children and young people have an understanding of what they are doing and why they're doing and who they're communicating with.
The more I'm learning on these things is absolutely incredible. But the one thing I suppose we haven't done is we've talked about individuals. What about grooming gangs and gang crimes? We've had some of that in Scotland. To what extent is that an issue? How much oxygen does that take up?
I always speak about tactics, the tactics that perpetrators use. And I think grooming gangs is a very, very dangerous term to use. And the reason I say that is when I first became aware of grooming gangs, it was when the British National Party were actually handing out leaflets in Wales around grooming gangs and about protecting children from these Muslim grooming gangs. And that was built on a lot of the high profile cases that you hear about in England. But we never hear about cases that took place in Torbay, for instance, in Torquay, which were actually young people who were aged 20, 21, who had groomed, and it just happened to be girls in a local residential care establishment. You know, we hear about the stereotypes that the media wants to reinforce and portray, but in terms of
Do you think maybe tactics. They're just not aware this is happening? Or do you think it's willfully either ignoring it or making it less prevalent? This is a conscious thing you think that's happening in the media?
Without getting too political.
No, but just I think, how does it feel?
Well, as somebody who's not white and has grown up in this city and has done a lot of work around this area, there's a political view in this country around immigration, which was in the back of Brexit, but also in terms of who's deserving, who's undeserving, who's causing harm, who's not causing harm. And I actually remember doing a piece of work many years ago. We did a joint piece of work with organisations in the Netherlands. And this is, I'm talking about 12, 13 years ago. It was in the area of child sexual exploitation. And what they were doing back then was, as well as working with, and it was primarily girls who were being identified. That doesn't mean that it was just girls that were being abused, but it was girls that were being identified. They had a model which we would refer to as a boyfriend-girlfriend model, but they referred to it as the lover boy. And they had a lover boy project where they tried to understand who the young men were, because as Stuart was saying earlier, it's not older, isolated, vulnerable men. It can be somebody who's quite attractive, charismatic, but it was young men who were befriending girls. But it was young men who were foreign nationals. English wasn't their first language. Their access to education and training was limited. Therefore, their ability to earn and to earn an honest crust was limited. So actually what this project did was they worked with those men to try to make sure that they were better informed about what they were doing and the impact that that was having on those girls, and actually trying to look at how they could help them have better opportunities in terms of access to education and training and employment, which I thought was a really helpful way to look at a particular form of exploitation, a particular tactic.
That's quite imaginative, though, isn't it?
But it was,
and not
and creative. And this was 12, 13 years ago.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean?
But that's not happening, is it, much? Is it because of, well, it's politics. There's a lot of politics going on.
I'm not even sure if it's still happening in the Netherlands, to be honest. But again, it's about having a much broader understanding of what motivates people. Do you know what I mean? Just as Stuart had said, you know, what adult sex offenders have said in terms of why they stop or why they didn't follow through with something is often because the child said no, or because they think there's a risk of them being found out, because that's probably the single biggest factor that prevents somebody from harming, if they think they're going to get caught. And that's why having processes and procedures and guidance and implementing those processes actually makes a difference. Because I remember someone telling me a story a long time ago about how they knew of this person who was involved in sport, and this person went from club to club to club, right?
But again, it's joining the dots and seeing
the pattern. And he was able to harm, but actually there was a gap in his behaviour and his sexual offending, and that gap I thought was because he was maybe caught and went to prison, but actually that gap was because he went to a club where people spoke about the issue, they had policies in place, they had processes, parents knew who to raise concerns with, children knew who to raise concerns with, coaches were talking about it. Do you know what I mean?
So it wasn't conducive to any
sort of
grooming.
So that person thought, actually, if I explore any of this, people are going to talk.
Interesting.
And that's why there was a gap.
Cool. So, I was thinking it was prison. I was thinking
that's what I thought.
Away somewhere.
Actually,
yeah.
No, it was
makes
because...
a lot of sense. I mean, just on the kind of current kind of media focus on kind of grooming gangs. I mean, a few different kind of connected thoughts. I mean, one is there has been a big focus on the subject in the media, but not much of a focus on, you know, the protection of children and all of this, not much of a kind of focus on and the needs of victims and survivors.
It's been about what the government hasn't done or what agencies haven't been
so
able to
do. So it does feel like
Elon Musk comment.
A very politically orientated kind of discourse, as Daljit said, and a discourse that has been unhelpfully kind of racialized in various ways, as Daljit has said. You know, we're actually kind of broadcasting, you know, in the week where a gang has been prosecuted in Glasgow, but it's a white gang. So, you know, I think we need to be very cautious there. But the last thing, which Daljit didn't touch on, but I also think that the focus on grooming gangs kind of takes us into a particular unhelpful space. We need to address that issue. But if you look at recorded sexual crime, organised gang-based sexual abuse of children represents around 5% of cases.
So we need to get into perspective about that.
So there's much more abuse taking place within families, taking place in online settings. So, you know, if we put all our resources around this big, hot issue,
then we're not.
My worry is that we're losing yeah. that thing about the 1 in 10 children who are probably affected by
it. I actually think you're spot on, Stuart, spot on, because actually if we have a particular focus on a particular tactic that's used
you're missing 95%
but also on who the victims are and what they look like, we're missing lots of opportunities to identify other perpetrators and other forms of perpetration.
Do you think we're getting better at saying that and saying, you know, because it did happen with all the comments that were made recently in the media, and then people were kicking back and saying, you're forgetting the victims in all this. This is becoming a political football. Mm-hmm. So maybe we are getting a bit more aware that we're missing the point
here. And to be honest, I suppose just as Professor Alexis Jay has said, we can have as many inquiries as we want, and we've had them in Scotland as well, but we need to implement the recommendations.
So that's it.
Rather move on to the next inquiry.
Can we look at solutions? Because we're coming to the end of our time and I want to go out on a slightly high note. That we, what can we do to make this better? Solutions. Is statutory reporting the answer? Stuart and then Dalgie. Dalgie's head's just gone down. Stuart, what do you think?
Well, so this is mandatory reporting, and it's one of the 20 recommendations that comes from the ICSA report in England and Wales. And there's quite a lot of interest in that subject at the moment. Alexis Jay was speaking in the Scottish Parliament just a few weeks ago on that particular subject. The quick answer is yes. I think that mandatory reporting potentially could make things better in some situations, but we need to be cautious about how it's implemented and who it applies to. There are dangers that we create systems which make it more difficult for children to come forward rather than less difficult. So we need to be kind of cautious there. Also, and this is really key for me, I think some people assume that mandatory reporting is this silver bullet that will solve things. I mean, actually, you know, as a social worker, all social workers and all childcare professionals in Scotland work under the auspices of the National Child Protection Guidelines, which require you to provide information about abuse if it's identified in any way. So we work as if there already is mandatory reporting. There are some organisations that set out with that, which is why I think it might be helpful in some situations, or don't really seem to work within the orbit of the National Child Protection Guidelines. But I think unless we connect it to some of the other recommendations in ICSA about, for instance, you know, a national public health orientated education campaign about what parents and members of the public need to know about child sexual abuse and what they can do about it, that we have some kind of governance body that goes in and inspects every organisation that has a responsibility in relation to safeguarding. You know, unless we do all of those other things as well, the mandatory reporting bit will have very little impact at all.
I think also on that point, what I would say is that for me, mandatory reporting is not the silver bullet, because actually just now, the main reason that workers, professionals, practitioners don't open that can of worms is because they're fearful of getting it wrong. Practitioner confidence is low. So actually what we need to do is spend our time helping raise awareness, and that's awareness right across the board. So anyone who comes into contact with a child, whether it's somebody who's sweeping the road, you know, whether it's somebody who's living with a child, whether it's somebody who's a social worker, whatever, we need to have a campaign which is about building people's awareness and confidence. And that's what I've seen happening in England and Wales by their Centre of Expertise. And that's why they are pushing for mandatory reporting down south, because there is a confidence that people are more confident, more able, and they're talking not just about those significant concerns, but also those low concerns. We've got a wee bit to go in Scotland, I think.
What's going to make that happen?
I think we have to have a national campaign, a national awareness-raising public campaign that touches every part of society in Scotland.
One final point. What could professionals do better, and what would make a difference? One thing they could do that would make a big difference.
I'm going to say two things, right?
Because, okay, do two.
Because there was a survivor who said to me once that the only person that ever talked to her about her abuse was her abuser, right? So basically, we need to notice and we need to ask those questions. And it's about saying, here's what I think's happening. Can you tell me a bit more? That's what we need to do. We need to be brave and we need to basically identify what we're seeing in plain sight and be confident enough to say, this is what I think's happening. And here's what I need to do.
Stuart, same.
We ran a webinar back in December for children and family social workers on prevention of child sexual abuse. And what we're trying to get across in that webinar is that, and we've talked about this already today, that the kids who are in the child protection system because of stuff around child sexual abuse or concerns around child sexual abuse are absolutely the tip of an iceberg. And then sitting below that are all the cases that are reported into social work, many of which, you know, are kind of situations where there are lots of risk factors, low protective factors, but actually there maybe aren't statutory grounds for social work involvement. Social workers can provide a little bit of voluntary support in those cases, but often are then closing them thinking, there's nothing more we can do. Let's see whether the case comes back in again at some point in the future. I think what we don't do is give social workers resources and confidence to use those resources around prevention. So with that case that you need to close, you know, have you made sure that the parents are given materials and resources so that the child has information about what abuse is and the fact that they need to go and speak to an adult if anything concerns them? Do the parents, and indeed the protective parents in that situation, know that there are confidential and anonymous helplines that they can get some kind of support with? Do they know that they can download a family safety plan and do that themselves without a social worker being involved? All those kind of things are there, but I think, unfortunately, we don't have statutory colleagues kind of doing that kind of stuff about empowering families to be better at prevention. There's lots of great practice and it does happen a lot of the time, but I would love to see it a lot more.
Wow, it's been... Can I
just say one more thing? Sorry. A lot of our practice focus is on harm inside the home. Therefore, we expect children to take responsibility and we expect parents and carers to have the ability or the capacity to protect that child. A lot of the harm that's happening to our children, and Stuart touched upon it in terms of older young people, so like teenagers, adolescents, is happening outside of the home. Mm-hmm. So we have to better equip everyone who comes into contact with children outside of the home to have a better understanding of what signs and indicators are and who they need to pass those concerns on to.
Wow, really valuable information from both of you. I am very, very grateful. I've learned so much. Thank you to Daljeet. Thank you to Stuart. And I'm always learning. And that's a wonderful thing. So thank you so much for spending time with us today on a very, very tricky subject, but beautifully explained. Thank you.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Cheers.